the sets, you know, and the way he did it. But really, he was kind of copying Shelley more than the book that it was based on. But that's the interesting thing about the cinema of that time, you know. It started in the fairgrounds. They would hawk their films in the fairgrounds. So they really relied on those things. You know, the horror movie that evolved in the 40s and the 30s was almost like a true child of the embryonic cinema that came, because that was the cinema that became cinema. It wasn't a literary thing in the beginning. It was the shock horror. That's what sold in the fairgrounds. You know, that's the true seed of cinema.
And yet it wasn't the Grand Guignol which showed everything at that time.
What do you mean?
The bloodletting and so forth. The theater of cruelty, which was a specialized thing for a while.
Yeah. But we don't really know what was shot, do we? We only see the tiny little surviving fragments. The manufacture of pornography was at an all-time high at the turn of the century.
Yeah.
But it's all gone. It's, you know, it faded away. It dissolved.
Except somewhere there's some nitrate reel in some attic or something.
Well, I unless they were restored, probably not. But then again, you know, Scorsese is sitting in his cave in New York. He's restoring quite a lot of stuff. I'm sure there's a lot of stuff that's restored.
Lost have come back, have reappeared.
Yeah, and but in the Akashic records.
Found in attics and so on, reels of film.
Now, I'm talking about the shelf life of that medium itself.
Yes.
Whether they're found or not, the fact that they would survive is contentious.
Well, in the can, it's pretty hermetic, and I certainly hope that my own efforts are still retrievable.
Even in the can, there is degradation,
yes,
sadly.
Yes, of course.
And we've reached the mark where that degradation is becoming palpable, no matter how well stored film is. Film is the fragile medium.
The chemistry is so.
Yeah, it's difficult to survive. It's made out of animal tissue. You know, it's gelatin. It's not forever material. Sadly.
Some films were on Mylar, which is super strong and doesn't scratch as easily.
But the containment of the silver nitrate.
Oh yes, of course.
Is in gelatin.
And some people have just destroyed whole bunches of film just to extract the silver.
Yeah, exactly. I mean the Mylar and the celluloid will survive longer than the actual film mixture. It's a silver nitrate solution that's the important thing, you know. Or the platinum nitrate solution.
AM 3 minutes into a new Saturday. Your electrodes get a charge. You may be slow and sluggish, but remember that vital energy is there that you need. Help you dealing with your family, all their quirks and humorous flaws and foibles.
And I do mean quirks.
Well, a chunk of last week's show, which unfortunately the first part of appeared in lieu of what I was trying to do with this particular show. Another one for posting very carefully. But anyway, that audio will be available if you need it for any reason.
Can't hear you.
One never knows about the copyright thing, what is allowable and not, but I guess you should always assume that if you don't know, it probably is tied up in a copyright form somehow. On a podcast like this, it doesn't matter, but on actual radio, you're supposed to keep track of it and report it all. But here, we are blessed in that nobody cares a bit what we do. There's no interest. The FCC doesn't care. It's not really radio. It's something that happens on a computer. They call it internet radio, but radio is a specific thing that this is not.
Well, radio.
And, yeah, it's the form of...
It's voices in the ether.
Yeah, audio, right.
I mean, Marconi would still call it radio.
But his waves would be absent.
They're still waves. I mean, the electricity pulses in waves.
They're not bouncing off the heavy side layer of the atmosphere.
So some waves are better than others. Still waves, still radio.
Yeah. And of course, the other aspect is you have to have listeners. I trust the that I did press the damn thing. It would be neurotic to look at the screen and see if the red button was pressed, so I won't. But you know, what an unnecessary thing. It's like in the mad scientist laboratory, there's a switch which, if pulled, will cause the entire thing to explode. And why install it in the first place?
Gotta move the narrative forward, you know?
Yeah.
The MacGuffin.
Well, it may be some security thing, but I don't. I just don't understand. But why would I understand?
Thanks for that.
It was a great pleasure. I hope it was fun.
Oh, yes, it was.
There's no particular great skill to it, but... it's a good thing to do, I think. Yes, well, I'll close before then, and I'll be there at 1 or as close to it as I can get.
All right, I have to go, but shout out Kurt Burdick, Mary Kalsick, Floyd Tageman, Zoe. I don't know your last name, Zoe, I forgot. I don't know who else was there. Nikhil Singh, Hal Robbins, Red Apple Comics sponsor. Thank you. Thank you very much.
And thank you for doing that. And shakes the whole car, he could set it off. You know, Republicans invented that too.
The rocking and shaking?
No, the car alarm.
Oh, the car.
The thing that makes the noise when somebody shakes it. It's a really obnoxious sound. I can't stand it. I can't dig it.
Noise.
Why I ought to. An imitation of this was part of Michael Pepe's original routine, Living in the Tenderloin.
Right.
Where he imitated all the sounds that he heard in his neighborhood. Those wacky Republicans have done it again. Changed the urban landscape and, of course, capitalizing on fear and suspicion. Okay. Careful, you're driving like a maniac in the monster coach.
Who had the Dragula? Was that the Monsters?
That might have been made by the same guy. Oh. Well, it was a near thing, but nobody died in that one. That tune has lyrics which were written at the same time. There's a whole monster song that goes with it. And it ends up, each verse ends up, the monsters are following you.
They're just performers, so aren't they?
Yeah, they've all got lyrics. The Star Trek music has lyrics. They all have lyrics. And, of course, you're following the monsters, not the other way around. Yes, that's a foregone conclusion. Now we're going to heliopter over the devastated area. See if... Yes, indeed, we're going to take care of this right here once and for all. Fluctuations of an unusual nature. And what am I supposed to do about it? Let's just see. Once again, I'd like to apologize for the earlier portion of the show when having guests and trying to hook them up properly to the equipment. I once again neglected to press the button that changes yesterday's show into today's show, and so a large part during which undoubtedly I lost most of the listeners was that last week's show, and not what we could do. But author Nikhil Singh was taking real-time movies, and so that early part may appear in some other different, distant medium. After that, we continued talking first to cartoonist Apple Berry and then to Nikhil Singh. Lieber Installer. Infinite spaces whose silence so frightened Pascal. There, perhaps we have solved the problem. Time will tell. Let us consider forms of things unknown. We have spoken of the noosphere and its attractions, that collation of legend and legendary lore. Who are the figures that stand out in this landscape? They are, to put it bluntly, monsters. From the Latin monstrum, meaning something to show or be shown, as in demonstrate. The human race has been enjoying tales, legends, narratives, fables, and stories of horror since the first time we sat around a campfire. Books have been written and published, stage plays have been produced, radio productions have been broadcast, television programs have hit the airways. The silver screen of cinema has immortalized many of these stories. What is the source of these tales? What is the source of humanity's fear, dread, and horror? Loss. Loss of friends, loss of family, loss of wealth, loss of health, loss of youth, loss of faith, but primarily, loss of life, death. Tales of horror are one of the few realms of human life which actually transcend politics. A child who wouldn't know a Whig from a Tory, a capitalist from a communist, an authoritarian from a libertarian, or a Democrat from a Republican knows just as much about the boogeyman under the bed or in the closet, perhaps even more so than any party chairman, king, prime minister, or president. In the United States, horror writers have spanned the spectrum from the political left wing, as in the case of Ambrose Bierce, Guy Endor, Rod Serling, John Coyne, Anne Rice, John Skip, but perhaps not Greg Spector, and Stephen King, or the political center, as in the case of Robert Bloch, Ray Bradbury, Richard Matheson, Robert R. McCammon. And over that border into the political right wing, in which you might tentatively put Nathaniel Hawthorne, Edgar Allan Poe, H.P. Lovecraft, Russell Kirk, William Peter Blatty, William W. Johnstone, and Dean R. Koontz. For left-wing authors, this can be a paradox, and John Coyne acknowledges this. As for my being a horror writer, he writes, I actually think horror is a very conservative genre. The horror comes when you do something wrong, when you challenge religion or society or nature, and then you must pay. Stephen King confesses, the monster which lurks in the shadows of most horror tales fascinates us because it appeals to the conservative Republican in a three-piece suit who resides within all of us. We love and need the concept of monstrosity because it is a reaffirmation of the order we all crave as human beings. We dislike change to the degree that it disturbs us and interferes with our own activities. But is this conservatism, or perhaps simply a feeling of wishing to continue a moment of tranquility, or laziness by another term? The horror genre shines a light on the transgressions of science with respect to life, the consequences of enlightened hubris, the dismissal of the sacred, and the abandonment of God, which inevitably creates a reaction. This reactionary foundation of the horror tale takes place regardless of, and often despite, the creator's personal political views. The bottom line is that the monster violates the natural order. For example, in the natural order, inanimate objects are designed and built for specific tasks. They are neither sentient nor homicidal. When the object becomes sentient and homicidal, the natural order has been violated. Jones, Stephen King, and several others intrinsically understand this, as did H.P. Lovecraft, who wrote in his essay, Supernatural Horror in Literature, horror is rooted in fear, the fear of chaos, the fear of death. Horror itself can occur in the natural world. One or two word movie titles quickly spell out the terrors that await us all once we step outdoors, from homicidal apes, such as The Ape in 1940, to The Birds in 1963, to rats such as Ben 1972, to frogs 1972. Yeah, they came after Ray Milland in that one. Anaconda, 1997. Wasn't John Voight in that? Piranha, 1978. Alligator, 1980. Cujo, 1983. Grizzly, 1976. Orca, 1977. And, of course, Jaws, 1975. We have also learned that our most terrifying enemy can be our fellow man, as we're all aware of Leopold and Loeb, serial killers, the Manson family, the Zodiac killer. So, we subject ourselves to real or imagined tales of psychotic lunatics such as Jack the Ripper, Norman Bates, and Hannibal Lecter. In the movies, we see other fiends, usually masked and or disfigured, stalking their prey, including Lon Chaney as Eric in The Phantom of the Opera, Vincent Price as Professor Henry Jarrod, the proprietor in House of Wax, and Boris Karloff as James Rankin in The Haunted Strangler, 1958. That was made by Richard Gordon. I saw it in a theater with Richard Gordon, who also made the intensely enjoyable Fiend Without a Face. And all of these fiends prefer intimate murder via strangulation, and more importantly, their horrible acts are believable and do not strain credulity because they are not imbued with any scientific, occult, or supernatural powers. They are simply humans with disordered psyches, yes, but still human nevertheless. There are also the natural menaces in the form of humanoid creatures of the unknown, such as the creature from the Black Lagoon, the abominable snowman of the Himalayas, and the snow beast, or films featuring ancient behemoths and leviathans lurking in previously unexplored regions of the earth, including The Lost World, 1925, King Kong, 1933, The Land Unknown, 1957. They're leaving out The Lost Continent, 1950-something. The Land That Time Forgot, 1974. The Last Dinosaur, 1977. Some of those I wouldn't cross the street to see. Or thunder lizards awakened and or mutated from radiation, like the beast from 20,000 Fathoms. And Godzilla, King of the Monsters. Or created from genetic splicing and DNA recombination, as in Jurassic Park. From the depths of the sea, it came from beneath the sea. In the earth, the Mole People. Beyond time, the Terminator. Or deep space, the War of the Worlds. And many other threats can be found, and they are all still plausible, still possible. The suspension of disbelief remains suspended. Here there be monsters of science, such as The Invisible Man, 1933, and 1958's Fiend Without a Face, 1958. I was a kid in the movie theater, and they showed the trailer for Fiend Without a Face, which struck the adults as very disagreeable. An indignant letter was penned to the newspaper of how dare the theater affront them by showing a section of Fiend Without a Face. If they'd actually seen the final scene, which beggars description, they would have melted down in their chairs, perhaps. All that was in this trailer, as I recall, was the death of the mayor when an invisible energy vampire kills him. But, of course, in the last part of the film, they become quite visible. Well, how about the Cyclops and Dragon in the Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, or the Tingler, the fear-fueled spine creature, Varan the Unbelievable, I couldn't believe him myself, as well as unnatural monsters like the immortal living Egyptian mummy, first brought to the screen in 1932's The Mummy, followed by many others, a long chain or conga line of mummies stretching back from the original Imhotep. Future mummies were given a different name, and perhaps it is for the best, since Imhotep perished in his second life at the end of the 1932 film. Other living monsters we have all become familiar with are the shapeshifters. Again, science is responsible for the metamorphosis of gentle academic men into brutes, such as Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. What of shades, spirits, and ghosts? While not normally a physical threat, the exception being ghosts such as Captain Blake in The Fog, Alma Eva in Ghost Story, and Christopher Walken's Headless Horseman in Sleepy Hollow. A good narrative about anything haunted or plagued with ghosts will always provide a chill. This is now a realm which goes far beyond science, fantasy, and even the unnatural. This is where the supernatural reigns. For what are ghosts? Spirits, not of the living, but of the dead. Yet with the long history of ghost stories in every culture and the fact that many people in the 21st century continue to believe in ghosts, they're still plausible. A ghost story can always be somewhat credible because it addresses the unknown. Can anyone prove there are no such things as ghosts? Of course, they can't prove that there are such things as ghosts. Then there are demons. And of the demons that are found in fire, air, flood, or underground, whose power hath a true consent with planet or with element. Spectral monsters that also cross cultural and religious boundaries, they are denizens of the preternatural. One of these demons, Cherna Bog, leads a dance macabre of demons and spirits on Bald Mountain during Walpurgis Night, All Hallows Eve, in Walt Disney's Fantasia, 1940, before succumbing to the holy day's dawning of the Feast of All Hallows. Chernobog retreats back into Bald Mountain as a procession of candle-bearing nuns emerge from the valley, singing the praises of the Blessed Mother in the final song of the movie Ave Maria. There's also an unnamed succubus known only as the Unholy, which attempts to seduce Ben Cross's father Michael. Another demon, Azazel, evades the justice of Denzel Washington's detective John Hobbs in the movie Fallen in 1998. Of course, the most memorable of all cinematic demons is the master of the southwest wind, Pazuzu, which decides to possess young Reagan of this very popular and lucrative subgenre. Yes, not Ronald Reagan, but the innocent portrayed by Linda Blair, who I met. She was on the conspiracy zone with Kevin Nealon. She wanted to talk about her healthful lotions and products and so forth. Well, then there are all those episodes of The Twilight Zone and Night Gallery, A Trilogy of Terror, A Child's Play, Puppet Master, and its prequels, sequels, and spin-offs, 2014's Annabelle and its sequels, and most recently, 2022's M3Gun. It's supposed to be reading like Megan, with a backwards E, which is a 3-gun, and its sequels. It was during the 20th century when audiences began to experience benevolent, four-wheeled personalities. There were the television programs such as My Mother the Car, featuring the car's owner, attorney David Crabtree, portrayed by Jerry Van Dyke, whose deceased mother has been reincarnated into a 1928 Porter Stanhope touring car named Gladys. Viewers would also see cars possessing lovable human characteristics on the big screen, such as Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, 1968, starring Jerry's more famous brother Dick Van Dyke as inventor Character Spot, who restores a wrecked 1920 Paragon Panther, which eventually takes on a life of its own. Another sentient vehicle was a VW Beetle named Herbie, also known as the Love Bug, 1968. Herbie was the star of several sequels and even had a short-lived television program. However, the Vatican decided that he did not possess a soul and would not be admitted to the Christian afterlife. Herbie the Love Bug remains an iconic movie car to this day, right up there with Doc Brown's 1982 DMC DeLorean D12 from 1985's Back to the Future and its two sequels. The 1959 Cadillac Miller Meteor Sentinel limo style end loader combination car ambulance conversion from as Ecto-1 from 1984's Ghostbusters and the two original sequels, and the 1982 Pontiac Firebird Trans Am from TV's Knight Rider, christened Kit Knight Industries 2000. The car was equal parts intelligent, innovative, heroic, bonded, and annoying. Fastened to its driver, low-browed crime fighter Michael Knight, played by David Hasselhoff. Like my mother, the car's Gladys, Kit was also able to listen and speak, and the voice was suggested by actor William Daniel. For a moment in that particular retrospective. I just had to check. To check whether the red button was indeed pushed. What a trauma it is to find out that once again the whole first part of your show, the forepart, the interior, only went into the ears of God. It won't even be possible to post them. Only the remnant after I got up and pushed the button. What a way to treat guests, too. Terrible. From Animals on the Rampage, Masked Lunatics on the Attack, and Creatures of the Unknown Striking Back, to Monstrosities of Failed Science, Supernatural Thrillers, Vengeful Dead and Inanimate Killers, horror takes on many shapes, both natural and unnatural. From Ghoulies and Ghosties, and Long-Leggedy Beasties, and Things That Go Boom in the Night, may the good Lord deliver us.
From his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
He did the mash.
He did the monster mash. From my laboratory in the castle east to the master bedroom at the vampire's feast. The ghouls all came from their humble abode to get a jolt from my electrode.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
They did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash. The zombies were having fun. The party had just begun. The guest included Wolfman, Dracula, and his son. The scene was rocking, all were digging the sounds. Igor on chains, backed by his baying hounds. The coffin bangers were about to arrive with their vocal group, the Crypt Kicker Five.
They played the mash.
They played the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
They played the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
They played the mash.
They played the monster mash. Out from his coffin, Rack's voice did ring. Seemed he was troubled by just one thing. Opened the lid and shook his fist and said, whatever happened to my Transylvania twist?
It's now the mash.
It's now the monster mash.
The monster mash.
And it's a graveyard smash.
It's now the mash.
It's caught on in a flash.
It's now the mash.
It's now the monster mash. Now everything's cool. Drac's a part of the band. And my monster mash is the hit of the land. For you, the living, this mash was meant to. When you get to my door, tell them Boris sent you.
Then you can mash.
Then you can monster mash.
The monster mash.
And do my graveyard smash.
Then you can mash.
You'll catch on in a flash.
Then you can mash.
Then you can monster mash.
Mash good!
Easy, Igor, you impetuous young boy.
Mash good!
Monster mash, Igor! Monster mash,
And so there you have it. There's just no love left. If they think you're past it, there's no love left for you. You can be flesh and blood. You can try. Just doesn't signify. You can do your best as you speed to your rest. You're not even gonna have time to cry.
one thing that money can't buy, according to the poets. So you see... There was a merry messenger, a mariner, a passenger. He built a gilded gondola to wander in, and had in her a load of yellow oranges and porridge for his provender. He perfumed her with marjoram and cardamom and lavender. He called the winds of argosies with cargoes in to carry him across the rivers 17 that lay between to tarry him. He landed all in loneliness where stonily in pebble song the running river Derelin goes merrily forever on. He journeyed then through meadowlands to shadowland that dreary lay, and under hill and over hill went roaming still a weary way. He passed the archipelagos where yellow grows the marigold, and countless silver fountains are and mountains are of fairy gold. He set to war and forying, harrying beyond the sea, roaming over Thelemy and Belmary and Fantasy. Of crystal his Hisabergian, his scabbard Chalcedony, of silver-lipped Plenilune, his spear was hewn of ebony. His javelins were stalactite and malachite, he brandished them and went to fight the dragonflies of paradise and vanquished them. He battled with the Dumbledores, the Hummerhorns, and Honeybees. Then coming home, he went along in coming home in sunny seas. In ship of leaves and gossamer, with blossom for a canopy, he sat and sang and furnished up and burnished up his panoply. He tarried for a little while in little isles that lonely lay, but found naught there but blowing grass, and so at last the only way he took and turned, and coming home with honeycomb to memory, his message came, and errand too, and daring do, and glamoury, he had forgot them, journeying and tourneying a wanderer. So now he must depart again and start again his gondola. Forever still a wanderer, a passenger, a terrier, a roving as a feather does, a weather-driven mariner. Lost, lost, irrevocably, irretrievably lost. In the abysm of time. dinosaurs, plesiosaurs, giant lizards, and a guy in a Tyrannosaurus suit. And that, the head of that suit is what is spot under the monster's stare. It's a universal picture. Anticlimactic as it may seem.
Yes, it does seem anticlimactic. And to tell the truth, well, that's just what it is. At this time, the Ask Dr. Hal Show, live on radio, ends its Bobcast day on listener-confounded-radio-valencia.fm. We hope you've enjoyed being with us in those moments when we were actually present. At other moments during our allotted, slotted time, we were not present, but rather absent, owing to a bewilderingly obtuse and stupid technical issue, which, for all its jaw-numbing simplicity, was too much for this unfortunate to comprehend in time to save the entire first part of the presentation, which exists in the records as a rerun, until that moment of realization, when I, Dr. Howland Owl, leaped up and pushed the red button at last, thus transferring the show to something that could be audited, as opposed to previously. And I was able to interview both of my guests and ask their forgiveness, too, for such inordinate bungling. Let us hope that next week we can and will do better. But until then, I must wish you all good night and good morning.
You're gonna treat me like you do. How many more times you're gonna treat me like you do? You took all of my money and all of my love too.
Just ain't right, that's evil.